Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. This hour, we'll look at a couple of new laws that target juvenile detention in the state. Some children younger than 12 have been locked up. What advocates say they hope the changes can bring. Another new law is aimed at helping survivors of sexual assault during the reporting process. But many police departments are not equipped to make it happen. Farmers are struggling financially, and many are keeping their old equipment rather than upgrading, a move that can affect the bottom line and the overall farm economy. Sometimes it's the small things. We'll hear how homeless individuals in one community can get free haircuts. And also how music has played a key role in the state's history and identity. And we'll recall the launch of the music program Soul Train. It's all coming up on Statewide. And this is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Starting off today, we wrap up our series exploring Illinois' connection to the nation's 250th birthday. Created in partnership with Illinois Humanities, it spotlights people and places that have contributed to bringing the ideals of the Declaration of Independence to life and shape the story of our nation. Randy Eccles brings us this segment.
Today, we'll be exploring the music of Illinois, how music tells our story, how it connects to the history, people, and places of our state. We have two guests joining us to talk about music, Dennis Stromat and Chris Villillo, both musicians with experience in the humanities. We'll let each of them introduce themselves. We'll start with Dennis.
I'm from southeastern Illinois. Musically, I've come from a couple different places. One of them that I always found fascinating was our French Creole history and the French Creole music from our area along the Wabash River. I grew up not too far from Vincennes, Indiana, which is heavily French, old French town founded in the 1730s. I spent a great deal of time in my late teens in the French Creole areas of southwestern Illinois and Prairie de Roche, Illinois, where I learned to play French Creole fiddling. And I learned to speak Missouri and Illinois French, which is a different dialect of French. Not Cajun French, not Canadian French. It is its own dialect. Was enjoying learning the language and learning about some of our traditions that have existed here for 300 years. Somewhere along the way, I was accidentally preserving this music, our stories, preserving our language. I finally realized that that was an important task to do, so I've spent the better part of the last 30 years doing that.
Let's also get Chris to tell us about himself.
I did not begin my career as a musician. I actually got my degree in archaeology. Came to Western Illinois as a staff archaeologist for Western Illinois University in 1976. I did that for several years, and when the contract ran out, I decided to give up archaeology and dive headfirst into music, which had always been my greatest passion. Was involved in the 1980s through the Illinois Arts Council, documenting the last of the pre-radio generation of musicians in rural Illinois, doing folklore work. I was fascinated by the stories of the people, the music, immediately began to sense the connection between the music and the history. The more I did this, the more I began to see this connection between music and culture.
So move your families westward, bring all your girls and boys, and cross the Shawnee Ferry to the state of Illinois.
Music evokes a sense of place. Dennis, you were talking about the French area of Illinois, Indiana, Missouri, and what was your first experience that pulled you into that music? What was that moment as a kid where you said, I like this?
It was cultural at first and historical, because I can remember the rendezvous going all the way back to the mid-70s.
What's a rendezvous?
A rendezvous gathering, essentially, when people would dress up in costume from the 18th century and reenact time period, doing trading. They would do some mock battles, but then there would be musicians playing. I was always interested in that, and what was going on and how that was reflecting our history, the area along the Wabash. It was where I had this epiphany that the English weren't the people who founded Vincennes, that it was the French who founded Vincennes. And I started asking these questions. What happened to our French?
A lot of families and friends and communities are what get people started in music. We hear about the French immigration there that made a big difference in your history. Chris, what other key influences are there in Illinois music?
There are so many strong influences. I was initially attracted to the great songwriters in the Chicago area, Steve Goodman.
They're all out on the southbound Odyssey, and the train pulls out of Kankakee. Rolls past the houses, farms and fields, passing towns that have no name, and freight yards full of old black men, and the graveyards of rusted automobiles. Singing, good morning America, how are you?
Michael Smith.
I used to be a young man, and dear Margaret remembers that for me.
John Prine.
Then the coal company came with the world's largest shovel, and they tortured the timber and stripped all the land.
People who used music as a vehicle to tell a story. I still focused on the songwriting, but I was also fascinated by the history and the cultural connection. It opened up this entire new connection of culture of all of these folks in rural Illinois to the music itself. I was so deeply struck by people. There was a guy, Homer Biedenbender, 96 years old. I interviewed him on a rainy afternoon. At some point, he brought out an old fiddle he had made. And initially, I thought it had been painted black. As I looked closer, I realized he'd carved it out of black walnut lumber. He told me how he had done this because he didn't have any money to buy a fiddle of his own, but he had taught himself how to play the fiddle. That connection of how people would make things happen without resources we take for granted struck me as important. All of the ways that music connected with the community, with their dances, with their get-togethers, with the jam sessions that Dennis was talking about. That resonated very, very strongly with me.
We are talking about music that tells our story, how music connects us to the history, people, and places of our state. This is part of an Illinois 250 feature that we're doing with Illinois Humanities. Any unique type of music genre or instrument that has evolved out of Illinois?
The music that Dennis represents is a unique pocket of historical music. The thing that struck me as I was doing folklore work in Illinois, it was much more cosmopolitan than I expected. Where I was at, we had the Mississippi and the Illinois rivers kind of coming in on both sides. There was a lot of early development, but there was also a lot of communication via the steamboat lines and the riverways with major urban centers. When I was documenting old music, most of what I was finding had been commercial music from the middle 1800s that had just been absorbed into the folk music tradition. I didn't expect that. The one instrument in my region that seemed to be particularly hot, and it's not unique to Illinois, but we had a real hotbed of it in West Central Illinois, were hammer dulcimers. I came across at least six different builders within a 20-mile radius where I was documenting this music.
Dennis, how about you?
You might find that our style of French Creole music that essentially is Illinois French music, it's not Cajun music, kind of like our language is not Cajun. It is not Canadian. It is somewhere in between. Our songs oftentimes might even be rhythmically different than a similar version that might be in Canada. As well, it might be rhythmically and even lyrically different from one in Louisiana. You find examples of songs that we have that you take really sad ballads, and something that seems to be typical of our French stylists, you know, the ancestors, is taking really sad songs and making them into dance tunes. There are tunes that the theme is not happy, but they took these songs and they turned them into fiddle tunes. They turned them into happy songs. They even literally took called songs, like contra style songs, where you call the dance, and turned it into a lyric of a song. There are unique songs that exist that don't exist in other parts of the French-speaking world that exist here. And the fiddle probably being the predominant instrument, but we also utilize the bastring, or the triangle. In Louisiana, they call it the tifar. In Canada, the bastring. Same, essentially, pronunciation. Percussion is a part of our music. Foot stomping, rattles are even a part of our music. And that comes from Native American introduction in the cultural baggage, you might say, of our music in the area. That is unique to our music where it sits. Also growing up in Southern Illinois or Southeastern Illinois, I also grew up heavily around Western swing music, not bluegrass. Bluegrass was not here. That's a recent addition in the last 30 years, but Western swing music was here. And that's because of the oil area, because we had Texans and Okies that came here in the 20s and left an imprint on musicians in the 1930s and 40s. We have our uniqueness.
You mentioned the foot stomp. Is there any other part of indigenous culture's music that has continued to be around to this day?
That's where it becomes murky. Using rattles, using percussion instruments, very different in some ways to other styles of French music or even what you would consider Celtic style music. Our French culture became such a blend. It's based on evidence from the Catholic Church, and it's based on evidence of even 23andMe, for example, of how many French have Native American ancestry. There were the first inhabitants of the first two generations were mainly men coming here in the early 1700s. There was a lot of intermarriage into the Native tribes of the area. Culturally, Native American just became a part of not only the cultural DNA, physical DNA, but musical DNA. Becomes hard 300 years later to parse that out.
As we celebrate the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence and you reflect on music and independence in America and here in Illinois, how do you tie that together?
Music is the way you can trace the evolutions that Dennis is talking about. When cultures could not cross or meet together socially, music is the first place they begin to interact. It's a very powerful force in bringing people together. It goes places that we can't go ourselves.
Dennis, are there any particular songs as we are getting into the anniversary of the Declaration that you find tie to it well?
French music, there was what was known as the ringing of the Liberty Bell of the West that happened in Kaskaskia, a bell that was given to the French in Kaskaskia, which was Illinois' first state capital. That bell was also apparently rung, you know, when the Liberty Bell was rung, when we declared not only our independence, but later on, you know, in the establishment of the United States. French music was being performed there, songs like La Guillonne, which is our New Year's song. Chevalier de la Table Ronde, Knights of the Round Table. These are songs that we know that were being performed at that time.
Chevalier de Table Ronde. Good to voir sur le vin est bon. Good to voir, oui, oui, good to voir, no, no. Good to voir sur le vin est bon. Good to voir, oui, oui, good to voir, no, no. Good to voir sur le vin est bon.
Songs that were performed when that bell was rung in Kaskaskia in honor of our new country. This was being done by people who were French. They were not English. They didn't really know that much about these Americans or Anglos. The idea was hoping for the best. I guess we're going to be a part of this. We also have an independent spirit. We also believe in independence. And the French of this area wanted to be independent from the English, just like Americans wanted to be independent from the English. And that's something that our Franco-Americans, our French, are just as American as Anglo-Americans, and more so in our area because our French were a part of it and literally giving roadmaps as the English came in. Those songs, special songs like the Guillonne, Chevalier, were probably played at the time.
If other Illinoisans or musicians are inspired by the anniversary of the Declaration of Independence and want to do something, what tips would you give them for trying to harness the two things, their desire to do something with music and the anniversary?
I have found that music can be a tremendous way to explore a historical theme because it has a visceral connection that can take you to a place. I have been very fortunate to be able to use that to create a whole series of shows that reflect different eras of history. If someone was interested in exploring this further, that would be a great place to start. Start to research the songs, and it's always, to me, the backstories of the songs that give you the greatest insights. The way the songs were used culturally, or the history of creating the songs. In our state, at least, Dennis's is in a more remote area that still has some unique pockets of early culture. Where I'm at, it was much more homogenized. You see a lot more of that music by the 1840s and 50s starting to develop. whereas his music comes back much earlier. But there's an awful lot of material out there where you can learn a song, research its backstory, and as a result of that, come away with a whole history lesson. That's a tremendous way to start to learn history, but it's a very accessible way too, especially if you want to share that music and those stories with a group or just among yourselves. The stories really drive the music in my mind. That's what really keeps us all culturally connected. That's that glue that kind of holds us all together.
What's the future bring for Illinois in music?
We're positioned as a great byway musically because of the Mississippi River, because of the Ohio, the Great Lakes. That brings us music, and we have so many different styles. Illinois is a big, big state. Chris knows this well. We've both traveled it geographically every which way you can possibly think. You're always finding something new. Because we're a big state, I think that there's a lot of room for a lot of exploration for music in our state. And I think that we're always going to find new ways to reinvent the old. The nice thing about music, it's something that's live and you do with other people.
Yeah.
That's what brings people together. You can only AI music so much. You got to make it yourself at some point. That's the magic of it.
I think of the Northern Migration and how it took the Delta blues up to Chicago and became electronic blues. Something else like that will emerge in the future. Chris, you wanted to add to that.
The Illinois and the Mississippi and the Ohio Rivers and the Great Lakes, they were the super highways of the day. In the early 2000s, I was involved in another folklore project documenting the impact of the Mississippi River on arts. The conclusion that we came to was that these rivers were essentially cultural ecotone, where multiple cultures come together, cross, and in that small segment, you have twice as much culture, and then a whole hybrid of other things developing out of that. Illinois was a pioneer state in so many ways. Country music was developed here much more strongly than people associate with it, and a lot of it in the Chicago area. We had the first radio stations west of the Appalachian Mountains in Illinois. We are continuing to keep a very active music scene going. I'm seeing young people get involved again, which I love. I'm seeing hybrids of old time and new music coming together. The future is going to be very strong for music here in Illinois. I would love to see it continue.
That's Chris Villillo and Dennis Stromat, folklorists, who talked with Randy Eccles about how music reflects the state's history and identity. And this was part of the Illinois 250 series in partnership with Illinois Humanities. Production assistance was provided by Allison Cuddy. You can visit il250.org for more information. We'll talk about changes coming to juvenile detention in Illinois. That's ahead on Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Peter Medlin has been reporting on Illinois' county juvenile detention system. Two new state laws look to reform it. He spoke with Elizabeth Clark from the Juvenile Justice Initiative about the impact the laws could make.
There's one of them that does a couple things, but I think two of the big highlights are ending the practice of detaining young children under 12 and then 13 next year. And one of them that establishes the Child First Task Force is another big part of it. Can you talk a little bit about, again, just some of the big pieces that are really important to that legislation?
Well, it was a 14-year battle to end pretrial detention, really jailing, of children under the age of 13. 14 years to do that. All along through those 14 years, the numbers went down, thankfully. But the research is clear that removing children, especially such young children, from their home is profoundly harmful, lifelong implications, including higher mortality rates, really profoundly damaging. Despite that, it was difficult to pass because opponents said, well, what else are we going to do with them? So part of the bill that passed is that in cases where children can't be detained, but you can't find alternative resources, probation will document that. Because one of the things we've never known is really where are the resources missing? Where are they needed? And what resources are needed? Is it temporary interventions? Is it behavioral health? Is it some kind of home placement? Documenting that is going to be a key part. A year from now, we're going to know a lot more about what resources people in the system feel are missing and where they're missing. And that's going to help us improve our system dramatically.
And the other big part of that legislation is the establishment of the Child First Task Force. Can you tell us a little bit about what that work? What are they going to do?
So a recommendation actually that's been on the books for 3 decades now is that the juvenile detention system be reformed. The whole system is murky and no enforcement and needs to be completely overhauled. The Child First Task Force, the first part of it is just to address that, to look at that. But we have very little data. We have changed the standard as well of detention in that bill. Not only did it raise the age, but it said we can't detain children anymore for property offenses. We don't detain adults anymore for property offenses. We're not going to lock them up anymore for harm to self, danger to self. I mean, that was always absurd. Danger to self, if they're a danger to themselves, then that's a behavioral health issue. That's not something where you punish them. And the other change is in failure to appear in court, which is absurd because you're talking about children who have no agency over where they go each day and who are legally required to go to school. And then you're going to jail them because they don't appear in court. So the standard is changing too. So I think a year from now, we'll know a lot more about who the population is that we're actually talking about.
If we're going to have a lot more data in the next year, what do we hope that data tells us?
And I think it will tell us that we need far, far fewer beds than we have right now, and something about where we need them so that we could begin thinking about regionalization rather than having 14 scattered. You know, you've got Vermilion, Champaign, and Springfield all in a row there. I mean, they're just scattered haphazardly across the state right now. Where we actually need beds, how many we need, what resources we need to put in place, all of that we've got to figure out. This is all going to be under the lens of Child First Justice. We will be leading the country in using this lens of Child First Justice. Child First Defenders second, looking at children as children, starting from the framework of the aspirations of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, what their needs are, what our obligations are to them as a society, and then all through a restorative justice lens. And they're actually, the governor just signed a bill that will encourage the use of restorative justice in juvenile cases.
You've talked about how a lot of that work and a lot of that push for restorative justice in this system actually comes from work happening and that it's been happening in Northern Ireland and actually has taken you and others on trips to Northern Ireland to learn more about this.
It's astonishing. It's an approach towards justice, and now they're hoping to expand it to the adult system in Northern Ireland. But it's an approach to justice that really teaches peace-building skills and really critical in communities that are particularly hard hit by conflict, by violence. That's what Northern Ireland tells us, that you can start up a system training people on how to dialogue with each other, how to work out conflict peacefully through these restorative measures.
The Juvenile Justice Initiative released a big report about a year and a half ago about the need to overhaul juvenile detention in Illinois, lists a series of recommendations, some of which seem to have made it into these new laws. I'm sure not all of them. For you, what are some of the more urgent areas that still need reform, that still need to be worked on?
It's a really big thing in the lives of children. There's only one county in Illinois that does a review of a decision to lock up a kid 24/7. So if a kid comes into most counties in Illinois, other than Cook, on a Friday, they're not going to have a court hearing of that decision to lock them up until Monday. On the other hand, if you come in on Friday, and you have a court decision that Friday, and the court says, well, you're not really a danger to the public, so we're going to send you home with these conditions, then you can go right back into school Monday morning, and you won't miss as much. Every player in the system is guilty of dragging their feet and saying, oh, we can't do detention hearings on the weekends. But you know, hospitals are open 24/7. Why can't courts do 24/7 detention hearings? And really, no hearing should ever be done without a lawyer with the child in person. That's really important, too.
Elizabeth Clark with the Juvenile Justice Initiative. She spoke with Peter Medlin. The town of Macomb, like many others, purchased some new squad cars last year. That led reporter Rich Egger to wonder how the vehicles have changed through the years.
Like with so many other things, the technology for squad cars has advanced by leaps and bounds.
The technology in here allows officers to do so much more than we were 25 years ago.
Chief Jeff Hamer joined the department in 2001. He says back then, dashboard cameras were new, and they were big and bulky. They even blocked a bit of an officer's view looking through the windshield.
Now what we have are HD cameras. They're much smaller. In fact, the one in here is smaller than a smartphone, about half the size. And then the hard drive is all the way wired into the trunk. So none of that equipment is kind of blocking your view.
While dashboard cameras were new in 2001, the use of body cameras was still a few years off. Now those cameras are synchronized through Bluetooth.
So when we activate our emergency lights to pull over a car, not only does it turn on the dashboard camera, but it also turns on our body camera. So that's less buttons for the officer to press or forget to press. And so it kind of makes a more consistent recording environment.
Hamer says that also helps the officer focus on the vehicle they're pulling over and the people in it instead of thinking about activating their body cam. The chief says officers today use military-grade laptops in the field with faster speeds and better processing than equipment at the turn of the century. Officers can easily take them out of the car and carry them right to a crime scene to take notes, photos, and video. In addition, squad cars now have articulated mounts for the laptops, allowing them to be adjusted according to each officer's height and preference. Changes in squad cars extend beyond the driver area. Hamer says the back seats of squad cars are designed differently now, too.
Now what we have is kind of a crafted prisoner compartment that's made specifically for prisoner transport.
Hamer says some of the vehicles have seat belts that belt to the door side of the rear cabin. This means officers don't have to reach across a person's face or chest to get them buckled in, and that helps them avoid possible hazards presented by someone being arrested.
Especially if they were a little bit combative or if they had airborne illnesses and things like that. We were thinking of safety on all fronts.
And instead of heavy gauge metal, a plexiglass shield separates the front of the car from the back. The vehicles look different from the outside, too. In the late 90s, Macomb police drove the streets in white four-door sedans with blue lettering. Now they drive black and white SUVs with black and gold lettering.
So SUVs sit higher up in traffic, we're able to see more. SUVs are popular, the prices come down on them over time. So not only can we see more, but it also holds the equipment a little bit better and a little more room for the officers and anybody else riding in the vehicle.
Hamer says SUVs are the vehicle of choice for most police departments, though some rural departments opt for pickup trucks. The Macomb department has 10 marked squad cars and another half dozen cars that are unmarked or for other uses, such as for DARE officers. They rotate out two cars every year. Each car costs about $55,000 to buy and equip. Hamer says equipment such as cameras and laptops can get reused. The chief says today squad cars handle better and include more safety features than when he joined the department. And he says with advancements in technology, the equipment is smaller, more rugged, and longer lasting. Rich Egger reporting.
Welcome to This Week in Illinois History. I'm Clint Cargill. On August 17, 1970, Soul Train premiered on WCIU-TV in Chicago. It was the brainchild of Chicago native Don Cornelius, who hosted the show and funded it with his own money.
And now, here is your host, Don Cornelius.
Hey there, welcome aboard. You're right on time for another super slick ride on the Soul Train.
Cornelius worked as a journalist, insurance salesman, and police officer before his smooth baritone voice got him into radio. He began promoting live music shows called The Soul Train at Chicago area high schools. Cornelius modeled the Soul Train TV show after Dick Clark's American Bandstand. Cornelius wanted to bring black music, fashion, and dances into American homes while portraying black culture in a positive way. The first year, Soul Train aired weekday afternoons in Chicago. The following year, it moved into syndication, airing Saturday afternoons in cities across the country. It also moved from Chicago to Los Angeles, though a local version remained in Chicago for most of the 1970s. Cornelius hosted Soul Train until 1993. The show continued until 2006, making it one of the longest-running syndicated shows in television history. I'm Clint Cargill, and that's This Week in Illinois History.
And you can bet your last money it's all going to be a stone gas, honey. I'm Don Cornelius, and as always, in parting, we wish you love, peace, and soul.
The Pokemon Company is now the highest-grossing media franchise of all time, even bigger than Mickey Mouse in terms of total profits over time across its video games, trading cards, and other licensed merchandise. A new exhibit at the Field Museum in Chicago is drawing huge crowds by hitching its star to the Pokeverse, using fossil Pokemon to teach about hunting and collecting fossils in the real world. Jessica Popovac has more.
In 1998, Arjun Mann was 6 years old when kids across North America caught their first glimpse of the Pokemon cartoon.
And I remember coming home every day, the most excited kid in the world to see the next episode.
I wanna be the very best.
I think it's season one. They go underground to this like haven where there are fossil Pokemon still living. And they run into this big bad Aerodactyl.
Aerodactyl, an extinct flying Pokemon.
I was already interested in dinosaurs and fossils from a very young age, but that episode really called to me, and that's where I was like, oh man, like this stuff is like really cool.
He still thinks so. And today, as an assistant curator at the Field Museum, he studies fossils and prehistoric creatures for a living. After traveling around Japan for 5 years, the Pokemon Fossil Museum made its U.S. debut in May. It displays real-life fossils alongside Pokemon with similar features. Arjun was on the team of field scientists who adapted it for U.S. audiences. He says the Pokemon Company chose the Field Museum in part because of its vast fossil collection. The field's crown jewel, an Archaeopteryx fossil that is considered the most complete specimen in the world, sits next to a sculpture of the Archaeops Pokemon, the same one from that cartoon. I met 13-year-old Deacon Woodard inside the exhibit.
You're really seeing the comparisons between these fictional creatures and these once-alive large creatures. It's really something.
And next to the skull of Sue the T-Rex, a model of a Tyrantrum Pokemon.
And you can kind of see where the inspiration from the real animal went into the Pokemon, and I really recommend it to anyone.
Deacon said he loves Pokemon and dinosaurs, so his family traveled all the way from D.C. on their Pokemon pilgrimage. But 8-year-old Talia Pompalii from Galesburg, Illinois, she's all about the Pokemon.
What was your favorite part of the exhibit?
Singing on the Pokemon. I just like how they have tons of different colors, and some of them are cute, and some of them are fierce.
A very cute excavator Pikachu guides visitors through the exhibit, sporting a brown fedora and a red bandana around his neck. Little excavator Pikachu plushies are kept behind the counter at the exhibit store, where there was a huge line the day I visited, and a woman in a headset running crowd control.
This is the part of your five-item limit. Coolio.
Because it's Pokemon, there's no shortage of exclusive merch. But Arjun Mann and his scientist colleagues hope that the exhibit inspires visitors to collect more than plushies, hoodies, and cards.
The kind of take-home message in this exhibit is to get you to get out in nature, start collecting, and engage in natural history, and hopefully engage with science.
The final section of the exhibit has information on the joys of not just fossil hunting, but also bird watching and collecting insects.
Interestingly, the whole Pokemon genre was founded by a collector of insects, like an amateur entomologist. So really those roots are built into the genre.
He says it's part of the reason the exhibit makes sense and was so fun.
Working on this exhibit was definitely like a dream job. If I was kid me and I knew that I'd have the opportunity to do this, I would have like jumped through the roof or something like that.
However, he said he came into this work for the paleontology, which to adult him is even cooler than Pokemon. The Pokemon Fossil Museum runs at the Field Museum through April 11th and then is set to travel to another location in North America, TBD. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Popovac in Chicago.
Still ahead, a lot of farmers are making do with older equipment. We'll have that story and more ahead on Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Farming is expensive, and this year it's gotten even pricier with the rising cost of fertilizer and fuel. Equipment prices have also reached record highs. Because of that, many farmers are choosing to fix their old tractors and combines instead of buying new. Harvest Public Media's Emma George Griffin reports.
If you visit Kellogg Family Farms in central Michigan, you'll see hundreds of acres of soybeans, century-old barns, and piles of old machinery.
Some of the equipment we'll never use again.
That's Dennis Kellogg, the sixth-generation owner of Kellogg Farms.
But it's amazing how if I need a part or something that's similar that'll work on even a different brand, I'm able to go and find something that'll work.
Kellogg likes working on older equipment. He says it's easier and cheaper to repair machinery that's not computerized. But in recent years, it's become more of a necessity.
More than likely, we'd update if we had financial resource and the justification for it. We have a budget we have to live within.
Kellogg and other farmers are coping with a tighter farm economy. With trade uncertainty and rising costs, producers don't have much more to spend on machines that can cost upwards of $1 million. Farm equipment sales have declined by more than 20% this year, according to data from the Association of Equipment Manufacturers. Drew Kinsey is an agriculture research analyst at the University of Missouri. While he says more farmers are now relying on old equipment, it's been a trend for years.
We go back 50 plus years ago, then it was much more common for every farm up and down the road to have new equipment.
He says until the late 90s, technological advancements made older machines obsolete. Now, Kinsey says even decades-old machines have the bare-bone capabilities to get the job done. Plus, he says new technology can even be installed in older equipment.
It's really been pretty revolutionary in the last 20 years as far as, you know, enabling farms to have older equipment still be competitive with the latest and greatest.
In Paducah, Kentucky, Donnie Edwards and his son have a repair shop on their 2,000-acre farm. That's especially handy since Edwards says new equipment is just too costly right now.
It's a tough pill to swallow. Well, you need to spend another $100,000 on computerized stuff for your combine, tractor, sprayer, everything that goes with it. But you're not going to make all that much more money.
Edward says he taught his son to repair equipment, knowing it's becoming almost a survival skill in farming. But by forgoing new technology, farmers may lose out on efficiency. That's according to Doug Hauser, who specializes in digital agriculture at Iowa State University. He says farmers have to be extremely intentional when deciding what services and equipment are worth investing in.
A lot of farmers right now are stepping back and trying to figure out their equipment plans, whether it's more maintenance or if it's time to trade into maybe not new paint, but maybe some used, updated equipment.
Some farmers are sidestepping big purchases, like combines, by hiring out part of their work. Laura Hafner harvests grain for farmers from Texas to North Dakota. She says it can be a cheaper alternative for farmers who don't want to repair or pay for costly upgrades.
Oftentimes, farmers only engage in harvesting for a short period of time. While they might use it for several weeks or maybe a month, the rest of that year, that equipment's going to sit in the shed or in the lot, not doing anything. It's not making money.
The service is a good option for some farmers, but it doesn't work for everyone. For many farmers, mending their old equipment is one way to stay afloat for now, until the farm economy improves. I'm Emma George Griffin, Harvest Public Media.
That story part of Tough Times, a Harvest Public Media series looking at the economic stress that many American farmers are facing. The first Monday of every month, a small canopy goes up outside the Galesburg Public Library to provide free haircuts for homeless people. January Ha reports.
Cosmetologist Carrie Rupert has been a familiar face for many homeless people in Galesburg. Under the canopy at the library, she offers haircuts, bed trims, hair washings, and other grooming services.
When I come up here, I set up like my whole canopy with my shampoo bowl, like all my little thing with like my clippers and everything like that. And I normally cut hair for like probably 15 to 20 people every time.
She also distributes water bottles, snacks, and cooling mats for homeless people. In addition to the library, she helps unhoused people at warming centers and the Galesburg Rescue Mission. Offering free haircuts was one of her goals since she began cosmetology school. After sharing what she's doing on Facebook, news of her work spread through the community. She also received a lot of support from the community. When she created a wish list of supplies she needed, people responded.
People were ordering everything off of it. Like, they got me every single thing that I will need for a long time. It's crazy. I didn't expect it to blow up like that. I really didn't.
The journey has not been without challenges. Rupert once got reported by someone who claimed she does not have full license to be cosmetologist, even though that is untrue. Nevertheless, Rupert continues to dedicate her time and skills to helping people in need. Having experienced hardship herself, she understands the importance of offering help.
I was on drugs, living in a house with no power, no water, no nothing, and just having a simple haircut or a meal really makes you feel a lot better about yourself, you know? It just shows somebody cares about you.
Beyond haircuts, Rupert also provides free food for homeless people every day. In the morning, she brings them water, electrolyte packets, and snacks like Pop-Tart or cereal bars. At night, she brings them sandwiches or something similar. She says helping others means a lot to her, and she hopes her effort can help them feel better. I'm January Ha.
A new bill Governor J.B. Pritzker has signed into law better accommodates survivors of sexual assault during the reporting process, but police are struggling to find the numbers to make it happen. Colleen Holden has that story.
State lawmakers have approved changes to the Sexual Assault Incident Procedure Act. They now require law enforcement to inform anyone who reports a sexual assault that they are allowed to have statements or interviews be done by an officer of a preferred gender. Women make up 14% of sworn officers and 20% of police recruits in the U.S. There is no guarantee a female officer will be at the station when a survivor comes in to make a report, or that the station will even have a female officer on staff, especially in smaller police departments. The Illinois State University Police Department currently works with a staff of 32 sworn officers. 7 of these officers are women. Deputy Chief Nicole Bleichner is the only female investigator. She would have to do any and all interviews should someone reporting a sexual assault request a female.
It really takes somebody special to want to be able to be an investigator for that, because it gets pretty detailed in people's lives when you're trying to investigate a sexual assault. And some people just, that's not their thing.
The city of Lexington, just northeast of Bloomington Normal, has a population of about 2,100. The police force has a staff of 7, all males. To accommodate a request for a female officer, Police Chief Tim Edmiston said he'd have to consult the McLean County Sheriff's Department, which handles overnight patrols in the city. Edmiston says law enforcement needs more female officers and needs more officers with diverse backgrounds of all types.
Having a female officer is not just about being able to deal with female officers. Different ethnicities, different male and female, have different thought processes, and it brings diversity into thought processes and to running an organization as well.
But smaller departments like Lexington just don't have that. There are few officer positions, and turnover is rare. The bill does, however, have a caveat for departments like Lexington. It only applies to departments that employ officers of more than one gender. This means smaller departments with all male officers, for example, would be exempt. State lawmakers also added a reasonable availability clause to the bill. They left it up to each police department to decide if they can reasonably handle the request. To Nicole Bleichner with ISU Police, the term reasonability may require flexibility.
To me, it's reasonable is if you can, then you should. But it, for us, it's just going to be, you know, time of day, day of the week, time of the year. I mean, it's going to depend on a lot of details for us to accommodate that.
If police can't accommodate, it may require rescheduling the interview to another day. Bleichner and Lexington Chief Tim Edmiston both say they're willing to postpone. Again, Nicole Bleichner.
Well, we generally wait 24 or 48 hours, sometimes a little longer, before we talk to them after the incident has occurred. So it's not something that needs to be immediately addressed.
Bleichner and Edmiston say they are confident in their male officers' abilities to handle sexual assault reports with professionalism, sensitivity, and care if they can't meet a survivor's request for a female officer. Edmiston notes each officer is required to complete sexual assault report training every 3 years.
If their request is not possible, then yes, the second option is going to be to try to reassure them, hey, I understand what you're going through. I've been through conversations with people. I've been through training, you know, to try to make them more comfortable.
Sexual assault is not exclusively a women's issue. It happens to non-binary people, transgender people, and men. While someone who identifies as non-binary or transgender may not be able to get an officer of that same identification, they can still request an officer of the gender they'd feel more comfortable with, male or female. Regardless of the availability of female officers, survivors are allowed to have a support person in the room with them during interviews and statements. This could be a trusted family member or friend, or a sexual assault advocate. State Representative Sharon Chung of Bloomington co-sponsored the Preferred Officer Bill. She says she believes the gender availability issue could be solved by communication and teamwork among police departments.
If there might be more women, say, in Bloomington, and they need somebody at the Sheriff's Department in McLean County to interview somebody, you know, these are sorts of things that maybe we can try and see if there's more, you know, more cooperation. And I already know that they work really well together, but this is maybe one of those things that we can really try and figure out how, what best practices are, how we can support each other.
Chung acknowledges some police departments would have a harder time accommodating this new law than others. To her, finding the perfect way to make this work means playing the long game. Chung says increasing gender diversity in the police force is more of an added incentive of this bill. At the root of it, Chung says, are sexual assault survivors.
I think that we're trying to figure out how to encourage survivors to come forward and to feel comfortable and to feel supported as they go through the investigative process.
Advocates for sexual assault survivors hope the new law will encourage more of them to come forward to police. It's not unusual to see the justice system failing survivors. For every 1,000 sexual assaults, 25 perpetrators are incarcerated, according to the nonprofit Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. This means that 98% of alleged perpetrators walk free, and only 3 in 10 survivors will report. Nastasha Powers is Assistant Director of the Stepping Stones Program at YWCA McLean County. Powers sees this new law as a way to change that.
Someone said, hey, this is an issue, and because this is an issue, we need to do better. We need to do better for survivors. And that conversation literally magnified to this bill being passed and survivors knowing or feeling heard.
Powers says she hopes getting more survivors to report will help lead to cultural change and remove the stigma that keeps many survivors from coming forward.
I think that it would also, in the right community, bring people together to be able to see that this is not an sexual violence is not an individual issue, but it's a systemic issue.
Powers says there's a litany of reasons why survivors choose not to report their sexual assault. Most common are a fear of not being believed or thinking it was their fault. According to Powers, another common reason is choosing peace over fighting. She says pursuing a criminal case that could drag on for 2 to 3 years can cause burnout, and that's just one of the several long-term burdens survivors must carry.
It's internally. It could be the school system. It could be work, right? It can be maybe their offender was a neighbor, right? All of those different things that they're trying to navigate while still going through the criminal justice system for 2-3 years. It's hard. It's heavy.
Even with the many reasons survivors choose not to report, Powers commends police officers in McLean County for doing what they can to create a safer space for survivors who come forward.
Colleen Holden with that report. Well, that will do it for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Be with us again next week. We'll return with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.